Hey, everybody, I'm joined today by British funeral director John O'Looney, who is from Northampton. John gave an interview, I think on September 14th, that a lot of people paid attention to about the unprecedented number of deaths that he was seeing following vaccination that, of course, were not being reported elsewhere. So thank you so much for joining me today, John. And can you talk about what you saw and what sort of brought you to go public?
First of all, thank you for talking to me. I really appreciate it. My first experience of COVID was back in 2019, at the end of November, beginning of December. I had a family that came to see me who lost a loved one in Northampton. And I would just say that I'm actually from Milton Keynes, which is like the next borough over. But I attended the hospital in Northampton and collected their loved one. And one of the complaints they made to me was that the hospital would not allow them to see their loved one in the chapel of rest that's joined on to the mortuary. And basically, the way this works, when someone passes away in hospital, they come down off the ward into the mortuary and they have a little viewing chapel next door to the mortuary. They can take people in, you know, if they want to spend a couple of minutes or whatever with their loved one. And the hospital weren't allowing that. So I went over there and collected their loved one and asked them while I was there, you know, why wouldn't you let this family see their loved one? And they opened the viewing room door into the chapel of rest, and there was kind of an inflatable pandemic tent, is the only way I can describe it. It was black and silver and had about 20 kind of slots in it. And they said, this is why. And I kind of said, well, what's that? And they said, it's there's something really horrible coming, we've been told. And this is like an isolation tent. So the word COVID wasn't used. I collected the deceased. I left in early 2020. The news of COVID broke. The hysteria began.
What month was that?
So that was the end of November, beginning of December, that kind of that week, that overlap.
Of 2019.
Yes.
Okay.
So
that's before anybody knew that COVID was out there.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, that's correct. So I kind of told family and said, you know, this is what I'd seen and perhaps you might want to stock up on a few bits. And I didn't really know what to think, you know. So the news broke early in 2020 and we were kind of told there was this terrible pandemic coming and they were showing pictures of people falling over in China. And I kind of believed it, but I was a little bit skeptical. And it wasn't too long before the BBC local regional news crew contacted me as a funeral director and they asked to come and do an interview with me. So I was happy to help, you know, kind of thinking that I was doing my bit to help things along and raise awareness. And they came, they sent a reporter with a camera and a cameraman. And this lady briefed me for about 20 minutes on the questions she was going to ask me and what she wanted me to say, the responses, more importantly. They got me to dress up in full PPE with a face mask and that, which is not something I would usually do because as a funeral director, you don't really use a face mask. It's not normal practice to do that. So I managed to find one because everyone was panicked buying them. And I wore this mask for this interview and it was well orchestrated and I kind of gave them the hysteria they wanted and I kind of beat myself up now because obviously many months later, it's not true. You know, I fear that it's just not the truth. Not long after, I had a family come to me who'd lost a loved one and it was a little girl of 6 and she'd died of cancer. And this was at a time when all the other funeral directors were taking coffins directly to the hospital. There was no viewing, no dressing or washing loved ones. They were literally putting deceased straight in coffins and sealing them at the hospital, which I kind of felt wasn't right. And this family wanted to see their little girl. And I couldn't bring myself to say no. You know, I've got kids myself. So I've got a child and I can only imagine their pain. I mean, this little girl had a brother of 5 and a sister of 7. They wanted to see their sister. So I washed her and dressed her and had her embalmed and gave the family that kind of time. And then I kind of thought, you know, if I can do that for them, I can do that for everyone. So I've washed and dressed everyone, even those with COVID. Because they've streamlined the process to collect them, i.e. there's no doctors in attendance now for home deaths or care home deaths, I've been able to bring them into my care often still warm. So I'm sure if they're infectious, I would have caught COVID because I've dressed over 100, 150 maybe people that have been labelled with COVID without any doctor present, no COVID test, but they're all COVID. And then the other thing that happened that started raising my suspicions was I had a guy who rang up early in 2020 and he introduced himself as John. His name was John as well. And he worked for a company, he said, that were a pandemic agency, and they were contracted out by the government to ring all of the local funeral directors. And they were going to do that every week on a Monday. And there were several questions he asked me. He asked me what my capacity was as a funeral home, how many bodies could I hold, how many I collected that week and where from, and how many were COVID deaths. Now, it was almost instantly the guy started deliberately steering me. And by that, I mean, the conversation went much like I picked up a guy from the local hospice. He was a terminal cancer patient. He died from cancer. I spoke to the family as well documented. There was no COVID test, no doctor in attendance. And he said, well, that was a COVID death. And I would kind of say, well, why was it a COVID death then? And he said, well, we heard there was COVID in that unit, so it must be, I have to put it down as a COVID. And I kind of said, but the guy wasn't COVID. He was a terminal cancer patient. It was well documented, you know. And then there would be, I'd pick up a gentleman from a care home. He was in his 90s. He'd been in the care home for 5 years. He had onset dementia and he was in the fetal position when I found him. There was no COVID test, no doctor present. But again, he was instantly labelled as a COVID death. And it seemed that everyone possible they could possibly get away with, they were labelling as COVID deaths and they weren't COVID deaths. And I'd hasten to add, you know, I was washing and dressing them all as well. So if it, these are people that loved ones have lost over a Zoom call or standing there in a hazmat suit, you know, saying goodbye to your mum or dad. It's not acceptable. It's not acceptable. So I refused to do that. And I washed and dressed them all. And even one guy that was run over, you know, he had tire marks from his shoulder to his hip. He was in ICU for a couple of weeks before he passed away from his injuries. He was a COVID death. You know, you couldn't make it up. It was a disgusting lies, just lies. And many of the families that came into my care walked through the door extremely angry and upset. One, because they felt they knew that their loved ones weren't COVID deaths. And number two, because they were frightened because they'd been labelled COVID deaths, that I wouldn't look after them and wash them and dress them. You know, so I had to kind of reassure them, you know, I would do that. Don't worry. You know, and this, I had other funeral directors recommending me to clients to come to me because I was the only one that would wash and dress these poor people. So there was that. The death rate didn't pick up at all. There was no pandemic death rate. And the vast majority of funerals that we do here in the UK are cremations, probably 95% of the funerals that we do. And the cremation figures speak for themselves. Last year, the cremation figures in my area were less than 2019. And then in March and April of 2020, it was well advertised on the media that there was going to be a lot of deaths in care homes. And, you know, they were transferring these COVID patients to care homes to die a good death. And I kind of remember thinking, well, that's really strange. You know, how can a virus target a building? It's either in the community or it's not in the community. Do you know, I kind of, sure enough, the phone began ringing and it was exclusively care homes, care home after care home every night. And I didn't get a full night's sleep for probably 3 weeks because I was called out every night exclusively to care homes. Now, I would hasten to add that all of these calls, there was never a doctor in attendance. There was never a COVID test done on any of these poor souls. And all I came across was deceased and occasionally a vial of midazolam that had been left on the side or put in a bedside bin. Now, midazolam is a drug. It's a brand name in the UK. This particular drug is used, it's a sedative. It's also used, I believe, in lethal injections in your country as one of the cocktail of drugs that are used. Now, midazolam is a brand name, so it'll be called something else in your country. It'd be easy enough to find out just simply by Googling it.
It's similar to Valium. And it's used, I think it's used, and I could be wrong about this, but I think it's used in surgeries in our country, and I think it makes you lose your memory.
Yes, yes. Well, the main, obviously the main body of people.
Originally it was used in pregnancies and deliveries, and it was one of the things that made women lose, have no memory of the birth. Which
yes,
I could be wrong about that.
Well, the primary use in the UK is obviously when you've got people that have got dementia or Alzheimer's, they may be physically very fit. Their minds are gone though, and they become very agitated as their condition deteriorates, and they become quite anxious and quite violent. Obviously, not deliberately. It's just a you know, a sad side effect of the condition. And gone are the days where we tie these people to the bed now, as they did many years ago. They do it chemically, and they do it using primarily this drug, midazolam. Now, very interestingly, since going public, I've had a large number of people reach out to me, yourself included, and some of those people have furnished me with some of the missing pieces of the jigsaw. Now, many of these care homes are run by local health authorities, so there is taxpayers' money being spent, and as such, you can put in a Freedom of Information request to find out what this money's been spent on, and there's a paper trail there for that. Now, I've spoken to people that have requested via Freedom of Information requests the past 5 years' records of midazolam purchases, and the increase in the purchase of midazolam at the time these deaths were taking place went up in different areas between 350 and 1,000%, and it's all been used. To give you an idea, sir, I've been an undertaker for 15 years, and 10 of those years were spent working for one of the industry leaders. They called the Co-op Funeral Care. Now, in England, they have around 60% market share, so they're very busy funeral directors. And in the 10 years that I worked for them, I used to be on call in the evenings, 1 week in three. Now, in this week that I was on call 24 hours a day, I was never, ever called out to a care home three successive nights. Ever. It's statistically impossible. As a society, we're very good at getting people to pass away in hospital in the UK. So if I had 10 people pass away, 8 of those would be in hospital environment, 1 would be in a residential address, and 1 would be in a care home. And yet for this brief period, when they were buying 1,000% more sedative, I was called every night to a care home for nearly 3 weeks. So I'm in no doubt what's happened. And that is as a very small family-run funeral home. So I would imagine the large funeral providers, the guys must have virtually lived in those care homes for those weeks.
Well, let me interrupt you for a second, because you have made this claim before, and people have been skeptical about it, and Trial Site News, which does not like you, and has, you know, basically has a pharma skew to it, has fact-checked you. And here's what Trials News said. Your claim that there was a surge in the purchase of midazolam by over 100%. And they found that claim to be true. And they said midazolam prescriptions used outside the hospitals in England were an average of 15,000 every month over the past 5 years. But in April of 2020, there were 38,582 prescriptions of midazolam written out. And that is over twofold greater than February figures. They go on to say the drug diazepam, also known as Valium, but much stronger. They're describing what midazolam is. According to the Mayo Clinic, midazolam injection is used to produce sleepiness or drowsiness and relieve anxiety before surgery of certain procedures. When midazolam is used before surgery, the patient will not remember some of the details of the procedure. Midazolam injection is also used to anesthesia to produce loss of consciousness before and during surgery. So that may be the reason that they give it to, that it's in the lethal injections, which I'm not sure I'm taking your word on that. But anyway, it is a curious thing, and fact checking by possible fact checkers has actually confirmed your story.
Very interestingly, when I engage with my families, I'm finding that the vast majority of them didn't actually go into hospital with COVID. They went in with minor things, totally unrelated, and then caught COVID in the hospital environment. Now, the way they determine that is using, obviously, as you'll be aware, the PCR tests, and they're running those on 45 cycles, and the guy that invented these tests.
And that's, of course, is Gary Mullis, who died before the pandemic.
Yes, yes.
Who won the Nobel Prize for creating the test, and he said that it was not useful for detecting illness. It was useful for detecting the degree or artifacts of illness that could occur in millions of people, many of whom, or most of whom, have never gotten ill. And Tony Fauci himself has said that the test is worthless when you use it in 45 cycles. And it's really odd. They allowed, and the WHO encouraged, and all the public health agencies in Britain, the United States, and the rest of Western democracies, encouraged the use of PCR tests at amplification levels that everybody agreed were worthless. A couple of months ago, CDC acknowledged that the PCR test, even when using at lower amplitudes, was incapable of distinguishing between flu infections and COVID infections. So there are a lot of unanswered questions about the use of the PCR, and there are, you know, just a lot of things that, you know, that...
Well, you kind of have to wonder what clinical basis did they put people on palliative care then? You know, if they discredit these PCR tests, and I'm aware, fully aware, having listened to the testimony of many a nurse and many a doctor that reached out to me, people were put on palliative care, end-of-life care, based on the PCR test that they've now openly discredited.
Except that I mean, I would have to say, when you're in a hospital and you can't breathe, they're going to put you on a ventilator. And they were told very early on in our country that remdesivir was effective as an antiviral. And so they put him on remdesivir, which is a deadly drug.
Yeah, of course, of kidney failure and death.
Right. I don't think that the doctors in our country and in England, who were the frontline doctors who were treating these patients, I think it's incredible to believe that they were not seeing something that was very, very unusual in these patients. And that, yes, you know, there was a...
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah,
I would agree. My feeling is, though, that a vast number of these patients were killed by medical neglect and malpractice. I have a large number of people coming to me who are only presenting at stage four because nobody is seeing them. Nobody is seeing them, but they're presenting to a GP early. They're refusing to see them. They're prescribing Gaviscon for 18 months. They're making appointments for scans that are constantly cancelled. GPs are sitting in their front rooms at home, working from home remotely on twice the money. So the situation suits them very well. It's a battle being fought on many fronts, but I'm seeing a general medical neglect. And this has been confirmed to me by a number of medical professionals, some of them still working. To give you an idea, I had a lady reach out to me, a Ghanaian lady called Michelle. She's a nurse who was working as an agency nurse. So she's been in a number of different hospital environments up and down the country. She's got 29 years of service. And she told me that they were taking in one hospital she worked in, they were taking people in, they were giving them a chest x-ray. And then based on the chest x-ray alone, they were put in on end-of-life care. There was automatic DNRs on everyone, do not resuscitate, without any consent at all, no informed consent on any of them. A number of the families that have come in to see me have confirmed this, and they saw it on the end of the bed on the clipboards, and they questioned it and then retracted it. So it's been a concerted effort, I feel, to generate a lot of deaths, and those deaths have led to the hysteria that's promoted a life-saving injection that I'm now seeing a large number of people coming into me, an unnaturally large number of people having suffered thrombosis heart attack or thrombosis stroke, or interestingly, organ failure. I've lost count of the amount of people, 28-year-olds, 32-year-olds, 33-year-olds, 40-year-olds, people that just wouldn't normally be dying. You know, in 15 years as a funeral director, this is really an unusual pattern, enough for me to be concerned. And very interestingly, I went out of my area to a hospital called Stoke Mandeville Hospital, and they're over in Buckinghamshire. They're a centre of expertise in burns and spinal injury. And now and again, I do go there once in a blue moon. I hadn't been there for a long time, and I know the staff in there, and I had a really interesting conversation. So I kind of said, guys, are you seeing greater number of thrombosis? And she said, the mortician said openly, yes, there are loads of them. And the injections, they're turning their, this was her words, it turns their blood to glue. I said, well, why haven't you said anything? She said, we have told them they're not raising the alarm. Why would you not raise the alarm? Why would you not want to talk about that and let everyone know so that people will stop taking it? And they shrug their shoulders and that's it. You know, it seems to me as though, and certainly from the professionals that I've spoken to who have reached out to me, they're being told not to say anything. They're being warned. And then if they carry on, they'll get rid of them and they will strike them off as well, you know, if they're too vocal. And as in the case, for example, of Dr. Sam White, you know, you'll be well aware of his case and his position. I it beggars belief. You know, this is a big hospital and a big mortuary, and they confirmed what I've said openly to me. And she actually laughed and said, well, it keeps us in work. I really don't think that's funny. I don't think it's something to joke about or laugh about. And here we have a big mortuary in a hospital in England confirming these injections are turning people's blood into glue. And that's what's given them the thrombosis. I'm getting a number of people come into me where they've been cut by the coroner from ankle to hip, where he's searching the femoral artery, the arteries in the leg, for these thrombosis. And it's ever-growing numbers. I spoke to a nurse who had 12 patients on her ward with blood clots in their arms. That's unheard of. You know, a blood clot used to be an extremely rare occurrence, do you know? And they're every week now. In fact, very interestingly, when a paramedic attends the scene of a collapse now, they asked key questions, like triage questions, when they arrive on scene. One of the questions is, are you a vaccine recipient? Because that is obviously relevant to their diagnosis and what they do next. You know, something really terrible is happening here, and loads of people are aware. Nobody's being listened to. And people say, oh, you know, you're an anti-vaxxer. I'm far from an anti-vaxxer. I've had all of the vaccines over my lifetime, except with the exception of this one, because I see the damage that it is doing. And you have to ask yourself, you know, 12-year-old children now, they're vaccinated in schools in England. These are children who can't buy a beer, they can't get married, they can't get a job, they can't have sex, they can't legally give consent. Yet they're being coerced behind their parents' backs. Why? Why is that? Do you know how many children I've had in my care in the last 20 months that have died from COVID? None, not a single one. But now, up and down the country, I'm hearing of child deaths. Those are the cardio inflammation. And they're also, I was called to a meeting with a guy called Sir Graham Brady on the 21st of September. Now, Sir Graham is a commissioner of the 1922 committee. You'll probably be aware of him. He's a very senior Tory politician. I attended this meeting. It was at 2 o'clock in Number One Birdcage Walk in Westminster. Very, very posh, lovely setting, big boardroom. I sat at the table with 12 or 14 other scientists and legal minds. And there was at least six or eight via a Zoom call. And to give you an idea of the caliber of people there, there was people like Dolores Cahill, who was advising the British government in her 20s. She's run level three bio labs. She's worked in level four. She's really at the top of her game. And you'll be well aware of Dolores. Tess Laurie was there. Stephen Frost was there. Dr. Sam White. There were loads of people. Sukhrit Bhakdi was there. You know, and we were all asked for our testimony by Sir Graham in our respective fields. We introduced ourselves, we gave him that testimony, and he barely blinked. It was quite apparent to everyone in the room he was well aware, and we were only telling him what he already knew. And it was actually felt that he probably gave us audience to see what we knew and perhaps report back, because he was told, I mean, the science was wads of A4. They were slapping down on that, and here's the science, you know. It wasn't just unverified claims. And it was widely reported in the Times and the Guardian that it was a group of anti-vaxxers. Dolores Cahill built her career on vaccines. She's not an anti-vaxxer. Do you know? This guy knew. He knew. He wasn't.
Same with Tess Laurie, who's a veteran advisor to WHO
Exactly that. So,
the world's leading
exactly that. So, so,
expert
so,
on pharmaceutical clinical trials, and she's pro pharma her whole career.
yes, yeah, definitely.
I just want to be careful about what we know and what we
Yeah,
don't.
of course. I fully understand. Fully understand. So now I'm hearing of children dying up and down the country, not in great numbers, thankfully. And I haven't had any in my care, but I've spoke to a number of people who have confirmed these deaths, including classmates, parents that have rung me up and reached out to me. And
Yeah, I mean, there's actually an article in Children's Health Defense this week that looked, you know, one of the key metrics that ACIP, the CDC committee, and Burbank, the FDA, FDA committee are required to look at before they approve of a vaccine is called the number needed to vaccinate. In other words, how many people do you need to vaccinate to avert one death from the disease? And with the based upon Pfizer's clinical trials, they were able to save one life from COVID in 22,000 people, but those were all adults. So the number needed to vaccinate, you need to vaccinate 22,000 people to save one life, according to Pfizer's own data. And by the way, there were 5 heart attacks in the vaccine group, deadly heart attacks, you know, mortal heart attacks, and only 1 placebo group. So for every 1 person they save, it's really
you know, what basis are these decisions being made on? I would suggest money, but well, something is terribly wrong.
I'll tell you what people need to understand, and what I think is driving this is that in the United States, and I don't know if this is true in Britain, that a vaccine gets immunity from liability, but only if it's emergency use authorization is immune from liability under what we have, the PREP Act or the CARES Act in our country. But once you approve that vaccine for adults, it is no longer, an approved vaccine is not automatically immune from liability. The only way to get that immunity legally is to get it recommended for children. And then it gets liability not just for children, but for adults. And that's what I think is motivating the push in the United States. For children, because it's the only way that they can get it protected. And the one vaccine in the United States that's now approved is the Comirnaty vaccine, that Pfizer's vaccine. Pfizer will not sell any of that in the United States until it's shielded from liability. So they're waiting for it to get recommended for children, and then they can sell it to adults and get protection. And I believe that that is the reason that there's this insane push to mandate this for kids, even though children will get no benefit out of it and huge costs. Dr. Joseph Looney, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're most welcome. God bless you.
Thank you for your courage, because I know that you are taking a big beating for talking in the way that you're talking.
I am, but I'll be honest with you, I'd be more concerned if I didn't speak out, because I will go down in history as a man who was honest and was on the side of good. I refuse to be complicit with this darkness that has taken us all globally.
Thank you very much, Dr.
God bless you.